Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us on this Monday. I hope you had a good weekend and were able to keep yourself, your family members safe, but still have a good time. Maybe relax a little bit. If you're someone who's fortunate enough to still have a job, still, I'm sure, appreciate those weekends. And if you're someone who is trying to find a job in this sort of an economy without jobs being available, certainly our thoughts go out to you during this very, very difficult time. Later this hour, we open up the phones to hear from listeners who are employed and are working from home. Would you like to see this continue even after it's safe to return to the office? Have you gotten accustomed to working at home and kind of like the routine or not? What is it that you miss? Why do you think your job isn't ideally suited to continue working at home? Or why do you think you're not ideally suited to continue from a home office? And then next hour, we'll talk to those who are employed but going out into the world, people who are doing essential or certainly needed work. Do you have enough protective equipment in the job you're doing? Has your employer done a good job of keeping people separated in the workplace or not? What sort of recourse do you have if they haven't? And we'll talk about how your job has changed if you're someone doing essential work out in the world. That's coming up next hour here on Air Talk on KPECC. We begin with our daily COVID-19 update. Joining us from UCLA, director of the university's Center for Public Health and Disasters. He's also professor of medicine and public health at the UCLA School of Medicine, Dr. David Eisenman. Dr. Eisenman, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. I hope you had a good weekend. Let's begin first with this positive early report we just heard on NPR News. The company Moderna saying that its early phase trial on 8 subjects shows that their immune system responded to their experimental vaccine in the same way that people who've recovered from COVID-19's immune system responds. How much weight should we give this early report?
Well, so you're right. The study was a positive early announcement of results, so interim results from their phase one trial. And a phase one trial is done. There are three major phases, phase one, phase two, and phase three. And phase one is really meant to test for safety of the vaccine. So they give two doses. In this case, they gave two doses to participants, 45 participants, age 18 to 55. And they give it a month time. And they check to see if it's safe and well tolerated. And they're really looking for all sorts of adverse events. And that's really the major, what they call the primary endpoint, is whether it's safe, whether a two-dose vaccination is safe. And it was, it turned out, in these 45 people, the participants really only developed mild to moderate side effects at the site of the injection. So they got a redness in the arm, a little soreness in the arm at the injection site, but things that, you know, people are used to experiencing usually when they get vaccinations. Now there is a smaller group that they looked at what's called a secondary endpoint to see if they developed antibodies to the vaccine. Again, this is not the main purpose of the phase one trial, but they did show that they developed antibodies and that they did it in what's called a dose-dependent way, so that the more of the vaccine dose they got, the more antibody they developed, and that some of these antibodies are what's called neutralizing antibodies, which in other situations, probably in COVID-19 also, are particularly important in stopping the infection.
So it's positive. There are multiple phases remaining. The next one, I understand, will involve 600 people. And the company says that it's accelerating the testing timeline. Is that something that you think can be done safely and providing still a high degree of accuracy?
Well, I think that this is all going as planned. I mean, it's going quickly, which is what was planned. They do have the platform, the ability to accelerate the process. We still need to make sure that, number one, it's safe. That's still, you know, we need to understand long-term safety of these vaccines. And of course, we need to know that the antibodies are effective. Just because you're producing antibodies doesn't mean you're producing antibodies that are effective against the virus. And so those are the next stages, the stage two and stage three, to look at stage three in particular, whether it's effective. And lastly, we'll want to know if the antibodies last, because if the antibodies that one produces go away in a few months after the injection, then it's not going to be very effective.
We're talking with UCLA's Dr. David Eisenman. If you have questions for him about COVID-19, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Separate from this trial, there's been talk about coming up with an ethical framework to do testing of healthy young individuals by exposing them to COVID-19 if they've tried different vaccines, to see what the immune response is and do they become ill with it. But obviously, you need ethical guidelines if you're even going to do a study like that, a risk study. So my question for you is, do you think it would be possible with a vaccine under development like this to do a trial like that ethically?
Well, this is a question that we're going to be dealing with, and the ethicists are already starting to discuss. There's a lot of discussion among epidemiologists and ethicists and policymakers around other forms of doing trials. So there's a topic, there's a type of trial that's being discussed called a human challenge trial, which will allow for a more rapid test of efficacy and safety circulating in a way that allows you to adjust the trial as you get new information. And it's being particularly recommended and pushed by an epidemiologist who's quite well regarded at Harvard named Mark Lipsitch. And so it is getting discussed. We are in a critical situation here. The concern is that it could take many years to get us to a vaccine. Of course, on the other hand, there is the concern that if we don't do these trials right, we will end up finding out late that there are safety issues. And I'm concerned about that because we do have a very strong and growing anti-vaccination movement in this country. And we don't want to give more fuel to the fire and to their cause. So I think we have to really maintain the trust of the population. And it's an interesting conversation, but a delicate time to be trying new things.
Dr. Eisenman, do you know off the top of your head what the quickest development of a vaccine has been historically?
Oh, well, yes. It's been several years. Now, top of my head, which vaccine that was, I've kind of forgotten. But in the past, it took 3 or 4 years to get a vaccine.
So no one's done it in 18 months.
No one's ever done it in 18 months, which is why this is really suitably called, you know, Project Warp Speed, I think the president has called it. This really is kind of the Manhattan Project of vaccination.
We're talking with Dr. David Eisenman, UCLA, where he directs the university's Center for Public Health and Disasters. He's professor of medicine and public health. He's also associate natural scientist at RAND. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Dr. Eisenman, no softball questions from listeners here. Keith, in the Fairfax District, wonders about children going back to school. And that a tough one, of course, because for many kids, they fall further and further behind in doing their studies from home. But you've also got the issue of how to protect kids, their families, and school staff members. Dr. Eisenman?
Yeah, the question of children going back to school really has to do with the question of, are children susceptible to infection And do children spread it to other children and to adults? And, you know, actually the studies are, there are several studies now showing that children may be less susceptible to ever getting the infection and less likely to be spreading it to adults. Looking at, for instance, the public health page of Netherlands, which I just happened to be looking at last night, the English version of it, they feel very strongly that the evidence shows that children are not easily infected and do not spread it among adults. And for that reason, they're bringing primary schools back. And this is happening in other countries too. And there was actually a good article over the weekend on Wired magazine, sort of looking at bringing all the studies together that support the idea that children may not be a major mode of transmission here. Now, I mean, I think we need to look at all the studies, both positive and negative, and I'd like to see the U.S. studies included in these kinds of assessments, but it's very possible, at least in other countries, to bring primary school children back, it seems.
All right, we're talking with Dr. David Eisenman of UCLA. Fiona Ng, our senior producer, found on National Geographic the mumps vaccine, according to National Geographic, considered the fastest development ever of a vaccine, 4 years. 4 years! Oh, my goodness. All right, does that sound about right to you, Dr. Eisenman?
Yes, I said 3 to 4 years, and I was going to guess measles or mumps, but I don't usually guess on the radio.
All right. That's what we have producers for, 866-893-KPECC, to actually give us the word. Winston in Long Beach says, interested in your opinion about hydroxychloroquine and zinc as treatments for the virus. And we, of course, have had some studies about hydroxychloroquine.
I am dubious about anything to do with hydroxychloroquine. There are so many studies now that have come out that are strong studies that have shown no benefit and have shown higher levels of adverse reactions. You know, hydroxychloroquine has been used for a long time at lower doses for other diseases, rheumatologic diseases, but at lower doses. And the doses that we have needed to use or were trying to use in COVID-19 are much higher, and they're toxic to the heart. So the combination with zinc, I know that that has been discussed and studied. I don't know the results specifically on that combination, but I think with something like this where it's shown to be toxic at the needed therapeutic doses, we have to do very careful studies before we use it. I, for one, would not want it used on me if I were to get sick with it.
All right. On the other hand, remdesivir has shown some positive results.
Yes, it's shown, I would say, moderate results. It reduced the length of stay in ICU patients, as I recall, from, you know, several days, by 4 or 5 days. And that's not unimportant because, you know, if we're trying to increase hospital capacity, the sooner we can get patients out of an ICU and home, the more capacity we have. But, you know, it's not something that doctors think of as a major therapeutic. You know, it's not curing the illness. And frankly, there are some concerns because while we've heard this announced in the press, we still haven't seen the peer-reviewed paper in the science journals about remdesivir. So, you know, we're using it. We're using it as part of investigation trials at the major hospitals. We still need to learn more about how valuable it is.
All right. Canoga Rich writes on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, as a high school teacher, I'm very concerned about my own health as well as that of my students. I often have nearly 40 students in class, many of whom come to school sick. I'm not willing to go back into the petri dish unless I know the risk to me is low. How will we really know when to reopen. And I guess this gets back to the point that you were raising, Dr. Eisenman, that, you know, maybe it is the younger kids that go back. But then the problem with that is, you know, they're on top of each other, jostling around. You know, it's much harder to keep them apart than it is high school students.
That's right. But if, in fact, children don't get easily infected with it, or if they get it, they get a mild version and they don't spread it, then it's less of a concern. Now, you can also add precautions if that's true, so that you just make it even safer. You can do, we're seeing sort of creative approaches to physical distancing in the classroom. We can, of course, monitor schools and neighborhoods, and if there's an outbreak, close them down. So we could add all kinds of public health measures on top of it if, in fact, kids aren't major transmitters of the disease. If they're not major transmitters of the disease, it should be less worrisome to go back into a classroom with it.
We're talking with Dr. David Eisenman, UCLA Professor of Medicine and Public Health. He directs the university's Center for Public Health and Disasters. Coming up, we'll talk with him about why, despite California's stay-at-home order, now more than 2 months in effect, we haven't seen a significant decrease in COVID-19 cases. We keep kind of limping along on the plateau. What's the reason for that? And this at the same time, more and more people seem to be coming out into the world. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with UCLA Dr. David Eisenman. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Dr. Eisenman, we're now more than 2 months into the stay-at-home order for most of the state of California. We have not seen an explosion in COVID-19 cases that's overwhelmed hospital capacity. In fact, Navy ship already left San Pedro, which provided excess capacity for non-COVID-19 patients. Haven't had to use the annex facilities, places like convention centers, to take additional patients. But we're not seeing the kind of decline after the plateau that we were told was likely from public health officials. Why do you think that's the case?
It is concerning, Larry. You know, California, we did everything right, it seemed, in the beginning. We were closing our businesses in late February up in the Bay Area, the tech businesses down here. The movie industry and other businesses were closing in early March. Our governor and the mayor, Garcetti, and the mayors across the, in San Francisco too, were really enacting lockdown and physical distancing much earlier than, for instance, New York. And we really looked like we were doing the right public health response. And in some ways we have. We only had 3,000 deaths in a population of 39 million, which every one of those deaths is terrible, but we could have had a lot more if we had not done those physical distancing measures so early. But still, we have these kinds of the plateau. We have not turned the curve down. We've plateaued the curve. And we're still seeing up to 70 new deaths a day. And this has just been continuing now for over a week. And it's concerning. And the best, you know, the sort of the biological answer is that the term that listeners have learned over the course of this pandemic, which is the R-naught, the R-zero, has not gotten down below one. We're still at the point where when a person gets COVID, they're transmitting it to one or more people. So we are not, you know, crushing the curve. We're not getting the R-naught below one. When you get below one, then when one person gets COVID-19, they over an average number of people give it to less than one person. So Why is that? I don't know. I guess the best reason we can say is that since lockdown was supposed to impose physical distancing, that our that people aren't doing the physical distancing we'd hope they do. And there was a CDC paper that looked at physical distancing across several states, across California. It showed that 50% of individuals were still leaving their homes in March and April. So the lockdown was really not being taken seriously enough, it seems, to get that R naught down. And we're still having cases. And the value of this lockdown may be lost because we are supposed to use this time to get the rest of our public health apparatus up and running so that we could come out and start to reemerge. And we just don't have that either.
EGW writes on the page, follow the science. States that have reopened have falling cases. It's time to check the media claim Georgia would wreck the progress that we've made. If this is all about social distancing, we would expect to see significant increases in cases in those states where people are coming out more.
Yes. And I know Georgia has been discussed a lot this weekend. I and lots of others have concerns about Georgia. First of all, it's too early to say anything. We expect the delay to be, 3 weeks between the time we see reliable data, between the time that physical distancing rules go down and reliable data of mortality starts to emerge. There's also been concerns about the data quality in some states. Georgia was caught with some very weird data where they did graphs of deaths and they put days in random order in order to make it look like it was descending, which is a very odd thing to do. And they took that down. Other states have had their testing results are mixing up the diagnostic test with the serology test, which tells you very different information. So we really need to see this data a few weeks out, and we really need to see the data in very clear, clean, and transparent form.
Now, I understand that it would take 3 weeks or more to really get a handle on fatalities, but wouldn't you start to see within a week or so hospitals start to get a surge of patients coming in from community spread?
You'll start to see it within 1 to 2 weeks. The incubation period, the median incubation period is 5 days between the time you're exposed and the time you develop symptoms. So, you then give it a couple of days for somebody to get a test and get a test result. That's another 4 or 5 days. And then to get hospitalized, maybe a couple more days. So I give it more like 2 weeks before we see hospitalizations.
Okay. And if you don't see that in the states that have done more opening than California, would that be an indicator to you that California should open up more? Or do you think looking at the plateau and the daily deaths associated with COVID-19, best not to do that?
Well, I think there's a lot of data that goes into these decisions. I'm not part of those. I think we have to be opening up slowly. The economic fallout is terrible in Los Angeles with 25% of people losing their jobs. There's no doubt there's health harms to this. I truly believe we need to open it up. I'd like to see much more testing than we're achieving in California and in Los Angeles. I'd like to see contact tracing up and available, which we don't have yet. We know how to stop this. We know how to stop transmission, which is isolation and quarantine. And we know how to deal with that, which is by doing testing in order to look at that. And I'd like to see all of those things in place better.
My understanding is at this point, we have more tests than people getting tested, that there's actually a surplus of tests in Southern California. So if that is the case, then who should be tested to start using that capacity?
While that may be true, it doesn't tell you the numbers, how those numbers work. So that you might get sick and get tested, but it might be 4 days before you get the results. And that's still happening. So that in those 4 days, you don't know if you're sick. And a lot of people are spreading the disease during that delay. So while the numbers show that we're getting tests per capita improvement in that, there's still a real delay in how people get that information back and use it to isolate and quarantine.
Good thing. People I know have gotten tests, have gotten their results within 48 hours. So that might not be representative, but at least that's the people in my family that have been tested have gotten pretty quick response. We're talking with Dr. David Eisenman, joining us from UCLA, where he directs the university's Center for Public Health and Disasters. He's professor of medicine and also associate natural scientist at RAND. If you have questions for him, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. There's a lot of speculation, Dr. Eisenman, about why Southern California, particularly Los Angeles County, has such a higher rate of COVID-19 exposure and fatalities than does Northern California. And people talk about, well, tech jobs up there, more people can work from home and the like. But I also wonder about density and multi-generational families and things like that. If perhaps in Los Angeles County, we have more people going out into the workplace, coming back to a multi-generational household, and that's increased the risk. But one of the things that concerns me is it doesn't seem like we have any information at all. I haven't seen any study that looks at the 3,240 people in California that have died from COVID-19, and that explains the circumstances. You know, were they working exposed in a retail environment? Did they get it from another family member? And why don't we have that kind of basic information so we can assess risk?
Yeah, I mean, that information is really important so we can assess risk. And right now, a lot of the data that's publicly available through the Department of Public Health, for instance, is from the notification data that providers provide to the Department of Public Health when they have a case. So when a doctor sees a case of a COVID-19 patient, it's reportable. They have to report it on a form to the Department of Public Health. And if you look at the data fields that are collected, they're really pretty scant. So they, for instance, in occupation, they only ask for healthcare worker, teacher, first responder, or other. Now, that other is a huge category, and that's where you start getting into the details of who are those, how are people getting the disease? Are they getting it because they're transit drivers or because they're working in grocery stores? And those are the kinds of details that we want in those forms, not just a miscellaneous other category that then never gets analyzed.
I don't understand why public health experts aren't working on this, because we know, for example, the percentage that are related to care facilities for older individuals. We know the cases that are coming from prisons. So with the institutional numbers we get, it's broken down according to age and race and ethnicity. But what would really be far more valuable, I would think, would be to understand where are the source, where are the avenues of risk. And I guess I just don't understand why that's not a priority, it seems, in public health.
I think it is very important. It is a priority in public health. Now, these kinds of forms, they need to be redone. I agree. There's always this balance that public health departments are walking, which is asking for a form that has too many details and doctors are not going to fill out versus getting the details that we really need. And also knowing which details you're going to need 2 months from now. So when they probably made this form back in January, they didn't know necessarily all the fields that they were going to want. So I think, you know, this does need to be redone. Some of your question can be answered with really good research, but it's arduous research. It takes a lot of time. It requires going into the records of all the people who died and finding out really the kinds of information that's not available publicly about them, and then comparing them to other people who didn't die so you can see if those differences are meaningful differences. And that's more of a research project, and that takes time. And we should be seeing those results, but they're not available yet, I agree.
Carolyn Upland asks about, we hear about these rare cases where young people have serious reaction, what appears to be something related to the virus. And then we hear that kids seem to be somewhat inured to it. So what's going, why do we think there are some kids that seem to have a very serious response to it?
So you can have both things. You can still, you can have that very few children get the disease, and that most kids, when they get disease, get fairly mild versions of it. And at the same time, you can have this, what seems to still be a very rare but severe outcome, which is this multi-system kind of inflammatory outcome that looks a lot what's called, looks like what's called Kawasaki's disease. And, you know, they're still working on figuring out what are the features of it, what are the causes of it. We have 100 cases that have been reported in New York City, so we'll know more from those 100 cases. It's still to be worked out what are the biological reasons why those children had this widespread inflammation in their bodies.
Eddie and Covina, can you explain why some people who contract the virus are asymptomatic while other people have significant symptoms?
The short answer is no, we really don't know. This is, we have to remember that this is a novel coronavirus that a few months ago we knew nothing about it. It wasn't even on our radar. So we are going to learn things slowly over the months and years to come. And these kinds of very important but complex questions usually take months and years to learn in new infectious diseases. So it's no surprise that in early May, for a disease that came out in the United States in January, we don't know the answers to these kinds of questions yet.
I want to thank you so much, Dr. Eisenman, for being with us today and sharing your expertise about COVID-19. And we look forward to talking with you in the future if you're willing. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Really appreciate it. UCLA Director of the University Center for Public Health and Disasters, Dr. David Eisenman, Professor of Medicine and Associate Natural Scientist at RAND. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Now, coming up in just over a minute, we open up the phones for those working at home, and I'd like to hear if you'd like this to continue. Once it's safe for you to return back to your work site, back to the office, are you looking forward to that, or would you rather keep working from home like you are? And what are the reasons you're leaning one way or the other? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We'll be back in 90 seconds.